years and years full of races, all that Carolina place.
Cut that CB shucking jive!
All you racing fans, stand up, clap your feet, clap your heads.
Welcome to the Goat Rodeo.
CRN Studios in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. This is Racing Through History.
Race fans, welcome to this edition of the Goat Rodeo as we go racing through history. So glad to be here tonight, and got a full crew of folks here to entertain you tonight. We were without one bopper. He had a previous engagement, but we've got the other gang here. We've got all kinds of stuff. You're just not going to believe what's going to happen. I'm going to start with Mr. Tim Leeming, say hello, and then Cody, and then Alex, and then Hugh, and then Jack. Go around, take it away, fellas. You're on your own.
Hello to the entire world that's out there listening to the show tonight. Hello to the gang that's all gathered in the studio and in Florida and in Georgia. All right, Cody, take it away.
You're next, Cody.
Well, normally Jeff would say, good to have you here, and I'd say, well, good to see you too. And then he'd say, all right.
So, yeah, you can just go pretend
you're
I did
right on your own.
Good to have you here, Cody.
Well, thank you. Good to be here, too. I just never change.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Alex Nickerson is here with us tonight, all the way from Florida. How are you doing tonight, Alex?
I'm doing very well. I've lost a few more hairs on my head, but that's what happens when you're starting to get to my age.
Yeah, you're starting to get a lot of age on you. What are you, 21? 20? 19?
23. 23? Oh, my gosh, you're really getting old.
Yeah, you're getting up there, buddy. You're getting up there in years.
Yep, how in the world are you going to handle it?
He's going to have a hard time. The man on the street, Hugh Lenoval, crashed the splitter.
Yep.
Is here. How you
doing
tonight,
that's Splitter? That's me. I'm doing just fine.
Yeah. Good to have you, Splitter.
Another year older, and I'm not deeper in debt, but I sure ain't getting rich.
That's the way it goes.
That's right.
Coastal Jack Walker joins us tonight, all the way from Hand, South Carolina.
Yeah, man. I'm glad to be in the studio with you guys tonight. Hate that we are bopperless tonight, but we got a full crew.
Yeah.
And three different states on.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's cool.
That's going to be really interesting, as long as Skype doesn't dump them.
All right. So I got the video feed up on the website now, so you guys can go see that I have Brother Leeming sitting in between the two guys. And
he looks like he's on the wall.
He is. He's kind of plastered.
Yeah, I'm probably on the wall.
Yeah, he's like a poster or something up there, isn't he?
Where's the darts?
He looks kind of flat.
Where's the darts?
All right, fellas, talk about the race. Who's going to start? Raise your hand. Tim, you're it.
Well, I didn't get to see but the last 77 or 78 laps of the race because I'd been tied up with a lot of things going on Sunday. I didn't think it was much of a race. It certainly wasn't much of a crowd. The TV camera tried very hard to concentrate on the part of the grandstands that was right in front of the start finish line, but overhead shots told the story that there wasn't anybody there. They had more open space in the deserts in Arizona and Nevada in New Mexico. It was just terrible. And I just looked up as we came on the air, the TV ratings were 1.9. What did I say? 3.2 million people watched that. I don't know what they're going to do, quite frankly. I thought the race was terrible. You know, there wasn't any racing. Keselowski and Jimmy Johnson put on the best race back and forth for about three laps. But, you know, it wasn't really any racing. It's, again, the same thing. Clean air, get out in clean air, and you can just walk away and everybody else gets back there. But I think the clean air situation this time was worked real good for the first place car, worked real good for the second place car, because Larson was running Hamlin down, but he ran out of time. And lap traffic also messed him up.
Well, it was fun watching Larson come from the back.
Yeah. I mean, that's all he ever does anymore is he comes from the back.
Yeah, I got to watch probably the last 10 laps, 15 laps of the race, and Larson was putting on a charge, and the announcers were trying to make it as exciting as they could.
As interesting as possible. Yeah,
but he had a long way to go.
They were saying on TV didn't hardly match what was on the track.
I know, that's what I mean.
But then you look back, and that's been the case throughout broadcast history. They always make it sound more interesting.
Right.
What was it? I don't know, during a rain delay, and I don't remember. I guess it was it was told on Ned Jarrett he was supposed to be covering the part of the pits that Petty was in, and he had to go to the bathroom, and they told him in his ear that you know, cover Petty's pit stop. So he just started his spiel and said the public never knew the difference until somebody flushed the toilet next to him. But he did the little spiel just like he would have if Petty had been there. Pulls into the pits, gas man plugs in, the right side tires are changed and down, now the left side, and he's away with a picture-perfect pit stop. And nobody knew the difference, even though he was in the bathroom. Why did he wear close to pit road? But when he made the stop, which goes to show you that sometimes what's told to us or sometimes even shown to us is not really what's going on.
So, I think radio did a great job of painting the pictures for him. They had people like Sammy Bland and Benny Parsons and Eli Gold and all those folks, Buddy Baker and Ned Jarrett, all were on there. But I first learned that.
Barney Hall.
Barney Hall, of course. Back about 64, I think it was, when we first started carrying the little transistor radio that you could put the earplug in your ear and listen to the race. And this was at Darlington. I think it was a Rebel race that year. And the race they were describing between Petty and Lorenzen had to have been out on Jupiter somewhere, because it was nowhere near what was actually going on the racetrack. They were talking about how close, you know, Lorenzo's right on his bumper. Lorenzo was 40 car lengths back trying to catch him. But,
you know, having fun,
I guess,
Jeff.
For radio listeners, it made it exciting.
Yeah, I tell you, one of the worst ones was Big Bill Connell. I don't know if you ever heard him broadcast.
I heard, yeah.
And boy, he was always watching something different than what I was watching. It was just totally different.
Well, it's interesting now that the announcers, the TV people seem to be in a booth somewhere in a trailer,
right.
and all they're watching is monitors,
right.
And they're really not seeing what's on the track other than what the camera people are seeing, and sometimes they're covering some mundane something while there's a horrendous crash going on, and they're just totally oblivious because they're watching a monitor. They're not watching
the same thing you're seeing in most cases,
right.
Yeah, that I don't understand, because they're up in a booth and they've got a view of the entire track.
Not necessarily.
It's what it looks like. But, I agree with you. They're describing things. What we're seeing on the TV is not what they're describing sometimes.
Right. I mean, like Formula One broadcasts, those guys that are announcing the races for the stateside coverage are in a booth somewhere in Charlotte.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Yeah, I heard there was a golf radio show that did the same thing one time.
Mm. Well, we can sit here making up, you know, like, what was that, Halloween in 1938 or 39, we had the Great Martian Invasion that everybody believed was real because it was on the radio.
Oh, yeah. What was it, War of the Worlds?
Yep, exactly.
War of the Worlds.
Orson Welles.
Orson Welles, War of the Worlds.
I'm glad we got a new sponsor tonight, Jeff.
Who's the new sponsor?
Nature's Bakery Fick Bars.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
If you're looking at the monitor, you'll see it.
Well, I just got a text message here that tells me, according to what is on the monitor, Jack, you're talking to Danica's armpit.
Well, yeah, that was about 5 minutes ago. Now I'm closer to a bag of Nature's Bakery.
Nature's Bakery, whatever. But they had, what did they get, 39 or 38 cars, I think, at New Hampshire. I don't think they had the full 40-car field now. I could be wrong, but I thought it was one or two cars short.
It was short.
Yeah. What was it, 38 or 39?
I think it was 39.
Yeah. So one short.
Most of the races this year have been short, though.
Yeah, one of them was 37, I think it was.
Yeah, it was 37, which was the lowest in 21 years.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, it was.
Last race at Wilkesboro had 36 cars.
Hmm.
That was the last time they had 37 or fewer.
Wow. Something big has got to happen soon in NASCAR. It's going to happen.
Well,
it's
see, the happen. Way they keep smoothing it over, and they're saying that what we're talking about is not reality because of all this other stuff they got. Everybody watches it on their telephones and on their iPads and watches it in bars or whatever it is. So television ratings are not an accurate indicator of what's going out. But I don't care how you cut that cake. What about all those empty grandstands?
I agree with you 100%.
And even then,
I'll tell you one thing. I am looking to see if this new president is going to accelerate NASCAR into the ground, or, you know, if it's going to stay the same, or what's going to happen.
What do you know about him, Cody?
This is a guy that I haven't even really heard of before. Apparently, he's been with the organization for the last 4 years, and he's held higher positions, and he was high up with General Motors for some odd years, but I've never really heard of him until this past week.
Yeah, that was me. I never heard of him. Of course, he told me he'd never heard of me either, but I don't care about that.
But you're a legend, Tim.
I don't even worry about that. But I agree with you, Cody. I don't know what he's going to do. I think he was probably put in that position, in my opinion, to be the scapegoat. If he succeeds, the whole world is going to be beautiful. And if he fails, what's the big deal? It was already going down the toilet.
Yeah. And it's all going to be blamed on him.
It's all going to be blamed on him. And his last name is not France. So no big deal there. So, but I don't know how it continues to survive. Yeah, I really don't.
It's going to be interesting to see what happens tomorrow night in the truck race at Eldora. Because that's been a sellout every year.
Yep.
And
they only see, 20,000 people there? They ought to be able to sell that out.
Well, they ought to be, but you never know.
But I would venture to say that there probably wasn't 20,000 people that watched the last cup race. There might have been more than that. It's hard to tell. The stands are so big.
Yep. New Hampshire?
Yeah. The ratings for New Hampshire were, I think, 1.8.
Well, who knows? They've taken seats out of everything, and they don't publish their actual seat sales anymore. So it's really hard to tell. And for the size of the grandstands, it was very sparsely populated. But you know, that's one of the things they've done to make it look better is look at all of the seats that they've removed from all of the tracks.
Yeah. Yeah, and even if you notice up there where the motorhome parking is at New Hampshire, which used to be packed side by side, you know, Rutledge Wood was up there doing interviews near the end, part of the race that I saw. And, there, I mean, the motorhomes had 20 feet between them, you know, and just a few people sitting out in lawn chairs watching the race there.
Well, one of the mistakes they made when they set those things up was, I understand the prices for those spots are astronomical. Yes, they're prime spots, but you still there aren't but so many people that'll pay the asking price for those spots.
Yeah, but they used to be all full. That's the point.
Yeah, and now they're beginning to wane.
Yeah,
just like the grandstands that they're parked where the grandstands were.
Yeah.
Well, I've heard now with the Xfinity races that all kids 12 and under are free.
Yep.
To get in
with a paid
the Xfinity or the truck races. And they still can't get enough people in there to make a good size audience for a dogfight.
Well, that's smart. That's a smart thing to do, even though they're not gaining a lot of people as far as filling up the grandstands. If you can get kids to come and be interested in it and become race fans down the road, that's a big deal.
Yeah, but they should have been
totally
doing
agree.
That
30
years ago. Or 10 years ago.
Yeah,
we missed a generation. We lost one.
Exactly. Yeah, a whole generation.
All right, who wants to go first? Raise your hand.
Tim wants to go first.
All right, Coastal Jack Walker.
Let's do it.
Historic race finish. The first ever historic race finish on this network with 10 red flags.
That's the truth.
And 50 laps.
Yeah, I mean, it's phenomenal. But anyway, tonight for the Carolina Race Place historic race finish, we are going to the New Asheville Speedway in Asheville, North Carolina. New Asheville Speedway promoter Bob Greenwood scheduled a 50-lap NASCAR late model sportsman race on Friday night, June 13th. That's when the problem
there
started.
There you go.
The race was to be run on the famous one-third mile paved oval. Friday the 13th was a bad idea, as it rained all day in Asheville. The race was rescheduled a week later on Saturday night, June 21st. In addition to the 50-lap late model sportsman feature race, there was also a consolation race, rookie race, and a 50-lap limited sportsman race on the card. After qualifying, the 15-lap late model sportsman consolation race was held. The consolation race excluded the top 12 qualifiers. On lap 4 of the consolation race, the top 4 cars were battling for the lead coming off turn 4 when they all got together. All 4 cars were wrecked together on the front stretch and were beyond repair. Eliminated from the feature race because of the wreck were drivers John Settlemyer, Glenn Knipe, George Gosnell, and Ted Sellers. On lap 15, Bill Smith of Alexander, North Carolina, took the checkered flag in the consolation race, driving his number 70 1958 Plymouth. The bad luck on Friday the 13th was still in the air a week later as the feature 50-lap late model sportsman race took the green flag. Ned Setzer of Claremont, North Carolina, led the first 6 laps before the first red flag of the night came out. Setzer continued to hold the lead when the race returned to green, but on lap 14 he was passed by Jimmy Leinberger in the first turn. 4 laps later, Leinberger's number 13 Chevelle spun out in the first turn, hit the guardrail, and brought out another red flag. Setzer's number 7 Chevelle was now back in the lead, but would be challenged by Harry Gant and Dick Plemons all the way to the checkered flag on lap 50. This was Setzer's 5th Asheville victory to date for 1969. At the end, there were only 10 cars left running from the 19-car feature race starting field. During the race, the red flag came out on lap 6, lap 9, lap 12, lap 14, two times each on lap 18, 19, and 25. That has to be a record. That has to be a record.
I'm telling you, the guy lost his yellow flag. Oh, it's the only one he had.
That has to be a record. Never heard of such a thing.
I guess because it was only a 50-lap race, they didn't want to waste them all on caution laps.
I guess
sounds
so.
Like a real goat rodeo to me.
Oh, yes. Man. It fits right in with this show.
Yeah.
Anyway, here's the way they finished. New Asheville Speedway, Asheville, North Carolina, 50-lap late model sportsman race, June 21st of 1969. Driving the number 7, Ned Setzer from Claremont, North Carolina, and a 65 Chevelle was the winner, followed by the number 77 of Harry Gant, Taylorsville, North Carolina, in a 64 Chevelle. Number 55, Dick Plemons, West Asheville, North Carolina, a 65 Chevelle. Number 3, Tommy Brown, Black Mountain, North Carolina, a 56 Ford. Coming in 5th, the number 89 of Tommy Houston, Conover, North Carolina, a 66 Fairlane. Tom McClory, Asheville, North Carolina, a 55 Chevrolet. Clarence Ogle, Swannanoa, North Carolina, a 55 Chevy. Bill Smith, Alexander, North Carolina, a 58 Plymouth. Gene Bodford, Burnsville, North Carolina, a 55 Ford. Art Bishop, Bavard, North Carolina, a 55 Chevy, finished 10th. Followed by Jackie Fox, Asheville, North Carolina, a 65 Chevelle. Jimmy Lineberger, Hickory, North Carolina, a 65 Chevelle. Oscar Carter, Hickory, North Carolina, a 65 Ford. Charlie Close, Asheville, North Carolina, a 66 Chevelle. Brian Hall, Hickory, North Carolina, and a 55 Chevy, finished 15th. Benny Curley, Hiddenite, North Carolina, a 55 Chevy. Gene Hoke, Hickory, North Carolina, a 55 Ford. Larry Setzer, Augusta, Georgia, a 55 Chevy. Cecil Williams, Asheville, North Carolina, a 55 Chevy, was the 19th and final starter for the race. The four drivers that were at the track with late model cars that could not even start were John Settlemyer, Concord, North Carolina, Glenn Knipe, Concord, North Carolina, George Gosnell, Zyrakana, North Carolina, Ted Sellers, Asheville, North Carolina.
Those weren't the four that crashed
yeah,
in
yeah,
the...
Yeah, those are the four that crashed in the consolation race. What a consolation.
Yeah.
So anyway.
That John Settlemyer, everybody remembers what happened to him a few years ago.
What happened to him?
He passed away in a shootout with police officers.
Is that right?
Yep. don't remember the details, but yeah, he was started firing at police officers, and they... He was in his 60s when it happened.
Yep. Yeah, to be racing in 1969, he must have been by a few years ago. But anyway, that was the 10 red flag 50-lap late model sportsman race at Asheville Speedway.
Now, Jack, was this the same track that was the Asheville-Weaverville Speedway? Or was
No, it's a different track. Asheville-Weaverville was, I guess, halfway between Asheville and Weaverville, I assume.
It's, yeah, if you look on Google Maps at the Asheville High School, it's pretty far north out of Asheville. That's where the track was. They actually plowed the track to build the high school.
And of course, there was two actual tracks in Asheville at one point.
Right, McCormick Field and the new Asheville.
Yep. Well, I had a real good experience at the Asheville-Weaverville Speedway back in 1964.
Better than 61.
What did you do, Tim? Since you baited
I was back. We had gone up to the race part in the infield, and I was backing up next to the fence over in turn 4, and it was high grass, right? Well, I backed over a piece of fence wire that was in the grass, which the rear wheels threw up, and wrapped that thing around the drive shaft of that 56 Dodge. I wasn't going that fast, but it really wrapped around it. So, to make it very interesting, we walked over to the pits to try to borrow some wire cutters or hacksaws. And, of course, Maurice Petty heard that. So, to make long story short, before the race got started, we had Richard over there, Maurice over there, Dale Inman was over there, three or four other people, all standing around watching me on my back under the car with a hacksaw.
In the grass.
In the grass. But it was great coming back through the mountains that night because that Hemi Dodge was rumbling with no mufflers.
Wow.
That's why you can't hear now.
That's probably right. I can't hear now.
All right, Tim, take it away.
No, let Alex go.
All right, Alex, go ahead.
All right. Well, I was going to bring up an article from a month ago that I meant to bring up then, but I forgot to actually mention. It slipped my mind when the race started. I don't know how many of you saw the article. It was on ESPN. It was by Ryan McGee, so you know it was a rag, but we're not here to talk about what it is, why it is. The name of the article was 10 Things That Ain't Gonna Happen Again, and it was related to, obviously, NASCAR, being a NASCAR columnist. And the thing that caught me, you'd have to actually read it yourself, I'll post the link in the chat. The thing that really caught me about this article was the condescending tone. So I'll let you read it for yourselves and see if you get the same vibe from it that I did, but I'll actually read his points. His point number one was, sorry, but debris cautions aren't going away. And he goes on, blah, 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 and he goes on to claim that, full disclosure, I worked for NASCAR's television production division when we were in the process of designing the exhaustive video system used to provide blanket coverage of every track, blah, blah, blah. And he says, it concludes a statement with, some sort of new trend that will one day go away, or that every caution will come with indisputable evidence of troublesome trinket and turn one, is kidding themselves. And that includes Tony Stewart. So not only did he take a pot shot at the fans, he took a pot shot at Tony Stewart, suggesting Stewart hit Kevin Ward on purpose. And the thing got me. I have a camera on my phone that I can take a picture. I took a picture. I was at a grocery store yesterday. I took a picture from over 15 feet away, and I could read the nutrition labels on the things on the shelf. If I can read the nutrition labels on a shelf, I find it hard to believe that Fox can't, or Fox or NBC's cameras can't get details of a piece of debris that's large enough to bring out a caution in turn one. Number two was, sorry, but the chase/playoff/whatever you want to call a championship format isn't going away either. And his reason why you should accept it is because it's better than races with double digits margins of victory that were over with 20 laps to go. A beep a bop, and that triple digit margins of victories for the title aren't fair. So, and he says he spent more meaningless November weekends in Atlanta than a Falcons fan. So, again, apparently a driver winning the title to him isn't deserving. So he mentions pack racing, which, I mean, pack racing, I mean, that's a product of spec racing. Number four, again, I'll gloss over, is Toyota isn't going away. Okay, we know that. In fact, NASCAR is trying to get more foreign manufacturers in, according to articles I've seen. Number five says TV ratings and attendance are never going back to 2003. To that, I kind of want to ask him, if you could combine mobile viewers and stuff, would it combine to the viewership from then? My guess would be no, since based off of the TV ratings in 2005, TV ratings were over double what they are now. I have a feeling that not more than half of the fans have switched to watching it on their mobile devices, though I do agree with Patrick Reynolds on that some of it is in fact attributable to mobile devices. It says number six, but qualifying is never back to being a big ticket item. Well, I think I kind of understand that, but a couple weeks ago I actually put on the Truck Series qualifying when they were at Gateway, just because my brother had never seen the trucks on the track before, and I have to say it was actually more interesting than one car at a time, because there was always something to focus on, and because it was truck qualifying, there wasn't the more sponsorship driven coverage, so they were actually covering everybody down to the back markers that were, you know, one of two races they'd run all year. Number seven, he says, is North Wilkesboro isn't returning. I've looked at Google Maps. The only way North Wilkesboro is returning is if you buy the track and plow the pavement and run a truck race. So that's kind of a moot point as well. says, sorry, number 8 is they're never racing back to the yellow flag. And he says having a green-white checker artificial thing, whatever, is better than a race ending under caution. So, number 9 is, sorry, but Dale Earnhardt isn't coming back.
Well, boy, that son of a buck is brilliant, isn't he?
Yeah, he's really... And he says that... let's see. I missed it. But, you know, it's just kind of a... You know, but what's the point? And he says, sorry, but... And then he lists a whole bunch of other drivers. And a beep-a-bop. And... I lost the line I wanted to read. He had a really bad line in there that just really...
In which one, Alex?
Because
I'm reading.
Yes, plenty of them.
Oh, when he was talking about the aero package, number 3, he said, alternative to embrace. Again, please don't go back to make me go back to covering races with 3 cars in the lead lap. Why? To have 5 more passes? As a person that loves sports car racing... I've seen incredibly competitive races in which the field was lapped, sometimes multiple times, and because the racing was deeper top to bottom, more passing and top to bottom in the field. So again, that kind of he's kind of going against his own point. He claims he wants the racing to be more competitive, yet he says he hated it when it was. He's kind of saying it was more competitive then. So if competitive is the definition of margin of victory, then why aren't you watching drag racing? Or better yet, why didn't your parents raise you better?
Well, you know, I just read everything that he wrote. I've never heard of this guy before, and I don't care if I ever hear of him again. I think they ought to put him at the American Kennel Club judging dog pooping contest. That's where his brain belongs.
I mean, I've read lots of opinion columns, and I've never seen one that was... Most of them, you know, they always have this... Okay, this is what this person thinks is needed for a healthier sport. I mean, we all have our version of that. But to... I've never seen an article that was so demeaning.
Yeah.
Kind of like, if you don't have my view, you're inferior. Ooh, that's not...
You are a total idiot. Give me a call and I'll tell you what I think of you for real.
10 years ago, people got fired for columns like that.
Yeah, where was this column, Alex?
This is on ESPN. I posted
ESPN.
It in the chat.
Figures. Yeah.
Some of the best racing you'll ever see is 20 years ago, the guy in 10th place fighting to stay on the lead lap.
Yeah. 20 years ago, we didn't have smartphones. We didn't have scoreboards that had all 40 drivers listed at one time. And all you knew was the top 5, and most of the time the scoreboard was wrong anyway. So.
That's right.
So I mean,
yeah, if you were astute enough to really keep up with it, if you were another Morris Metcalf, you'd know that the scoreboard was way, way off from what the reality was.
If you were Morris Metcalf, you knew that Lee wasn't really running it first.
Right.
But the racing was good because you didn't know all that kind of stuff. You just saw cars trying to pass each other.
That's very true.
Yeah, Morris Metcalf did his best to teach me how to score a race many years ago, and I finally, just after about the third try, apologized to him. I said, this is way above my head. I'm going to bow out of this. I want to be a scorer.
I got a bad Morris Metcalf story, if you want, briefly, before we move on to the next person.
Go ahead.
When Boris Metcalf was still in charge of NASCAR timing and scoring, was still in charge of what happened in the booth, he was simultaneously the president of the Lee Petty fan club.
I did not
trivia.
Know that.
Yeah.
That is trivia. I didn't know that.
I imagine he didn't want a lot of people to know that.
Well.
Yeah. All right, who wants to go next?
How many of the 200 are attributed to Morris Metcalf?
It'd be more a question of how many of Lee Petty's 54 are. Because there are at least 4 or 5 that have been definitely left questionable.
Yeah. All right, Cody, take it away.
All right. So nothing real formal today, but I just wanted to talk real quickly about This past week, a good friend of mine passed away. He, I've known him for over 10 years. He was a lot like an uncle to me. And he was the one that took me to my first automobile race when I was, 9 years old or something like that. And, you know, just got to thinking, he was a hilarious guy, but just the memories you can make with somebody. And I always say, I always love the stories of half the time getting to the race is more exciting than the race was itself. And that's just the thing. You know, when I went to my first race in whatever year it was when I was 9, you know, I don't remember who won the race. I don't remember anything about the cars that day. I don't remember what classes were racing. This was a Dixie Speedway, by the way, a dirt track in Woodstock, Georgia. And, you know, I don't remember who won anything about the cars or what, but I can remember the trip there and the trip back. And I'm sure a lot of other people can. One of my favorite stories about going to the track relating to Georgia racing was Gober Sosby. And they were flat towing his race car to Daytona Beach, and halfway there the tow car broke down, so they unhooked the race car and towed the tow car with the race car to the track. So I just love hearing all the stories about, you know, going to the races, coming back, the traveling to the racetrack is often more fun than watching the race itself. So, you know, nothing real formal, but I just wanted to go around and see if anybody had, you know, interesting or funny stories going to a race.
It's a shame Bobby's not here tonight. He has all kinds of stories. And Let me tell you for sure, every time we go to the track, it's an adventure. We've changed water pumps. We've changed I don't know how many tires. We've stopped and added water. It seemed like every few hundred yards all the way to Wilson and back. We've had an adventure almost every time we leave Shalote in his hauler. So,
you know, I was thinking before we came on the air, and I was, you know, thinking about what I want to talk about. I remember a couple of years ago, you and I guess Hugh, it was you and Bobby talking about one of your Bell and Bell races you're coming back from, and somehow the story got to where you were pulled over on the side of the road at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, and somebody was looking for some glasses or for some.
No,
teeth.
It's his false teeth. It's Bill.
Bill Tripp
lost his false teeth. Yeah, and they were in his pocket.
No, that's not true.
Yes,
that
is it
true.
Is. Yeah, that was true. That was when we were.
Come back from Lakeview or something?
I believe that was when we came back from Daytona from one of the parade adventures. And when they got back to Bobby's house to unload his car off that tandem trailer that Bill managed to run over everything between Shalote and Daytona.
Yeah, I was with you all
you
that time. Yeah.
I don't know how many stop signs.
He hit everything but the gas pedal.
But
drove about 20 miles an hour.
Somewhere in Bobby's front yard, he managed to, or thought he had lost his false teeth. I think he finally found them in his jacket pocket or something. But you're absolutely correct. Going the trip to and from the track can be a real adventure. I was going to Charlotte to work a race 1 year. And got within 2 or 3 miles of the track and dropped a valve in the motorhome. So we worked on it off and on all weekend so I could get back from Charlotte back home. So, yeah, getting there and back is also part of the adventure.
Yes. Okay, my story isn't much of a story really related to going to a race. It was going to Daytona actually for one of those February events like the parade. And every time we go to those things, I always bring my copy of the NASCAR Chronicle because that's what I have drivers, crew members, whoever sign if I meet somebody I haven't met before. And one time we left the house about 10 minutes down the road. We were almost in the interstate and realized, I forgot the NASCAR Chronicle of all things. Turn around, get up there, almost missed everything.
All right, who's
next? Is that
your
story, Alex? All right, here's my story, and my brother Richard is probably listening, and I know he's going to get a kick out of this one. We left Charlotte in 1970 after, I think it was the World 600, and we had identical Plymouth Roadrunners. Mine was blue, and his was orange.
Then they weren't identical.
I thought they were identical.
Well, yeah. They all some color then. If we're going to be nitpicking, then it was all but color.
What year were they? 68 or
69? 1969, Plymouth Roadrunners.
Similar, not congruent.
Everything. So we're coming out of Charlotte Motor Speedway.
Did they have 383s in them or 440s?
383s.
Okay.
So we're coming out of Charlotte Motor Speedway and coming down that four-lane, two-lane each way back then, whatever the road was.
29.
We were cruising along. We must have been going maybe 35, 40 miles an hour. Traffic was moving pretty good. And this Oldsmobile switched lanes right in front of me, and I hit the brakes. How in the hell I missed that guy, I will never know. But Richard plowed into the back of my Roadrunner. I mean, he plowed into it. Had the whole back end stick it up in the air. It looked like that yellow banana Junior Johnson had. Well, it knocked the radiator out of Ricky's car. Well, we were sitting there trying to figure out what we were going to do when the North Carolina Highway Patrol racing team comes along, and they tell us, well, you know, here's the problem. Ricky's sitting in Mecklenburg County, and I'm sitting in Wasa County next to it. You, right there at the county line outside the track. One of us is Mecklenburg County, and the other one's some other county.
Oh,
I was in one county. He was in the other county. So we had to fill out North Carolina Highway Patrol report, Mecklenburg County Sheriff Highway Patrol report, and whatever this other one was.
That would have been Cabarrus County.
Cabarrus County, that Cabarrus, was it.
Oh, yeah.
So then we're trying to figure out what we're going to do to get him home. Well, at the race that day, we had met this gentleman with his son that had parked beside us, and we had gotten to know them pretty good. And so he said, well, I'll tell you what, let's go downtown, and I know where we can get a tow bar, because my car had a trailer hitch on it. I know where we can get a tow bar, and we'll come back up here, and we'll hook Richard's Roadrunner up to the back of yours, and you pull him home. So that's what we did. Ricky and all the people in his car were hooked up to the back of my car. We'd go down the road. So the next morning, since we were all insured with Allstate Insurance, we towed the cars just like that to the Allstate Claims Office. And they brought everybody in the building, Allstate employees and everybody else, out to the parking lot to look at this run that hit the one in the rear and the one in the front. Was all tore up, but that was one of our most exciting things. Then there was a great 100 mile an hour donut pass off that we did going to the Daytona 500 one year, but that's mundane compared to the big wreck.
What about you win that competition?
What, the donut pass off?
No, the best going to the track story.
I was leaving the track. I'll tell you another one about
he has a better
the track
one
too. We were coming out of Charlotte. This, again, was at Charlotte, so you weren't doing your job.
Hey, but we my job always, is on the track. It's not out
we
in the
were always just about the last ones to leave the infield, so we were pulling out of the Charlotte, you know, down at the end of pit road where you exited going out over turn one back in those days.
Yeah, gate eight.
Yeah.
Under the condos.
And there was a Ford pickup truck with about seven or eight guys in the back of it in front of us. And then there was a little Chevelle behind him. And then I was next in line. And Ricky was next in line. And a buddy of ours in a 55 Chevrolet was next in line. And that Ford truck stopped right at the track. I mean, there was nobody else around. But that Ford truck stopped. And I'm sitting to myself saying, don't you do it. Don't you do it. But he did. He turned
he did turn left.
And around the track we started. So I am not kidding you. We were absolutely blasting that track. We must have made eight or nine laps around that track. So hard, I was running up against the outside rail so hard, I blistered my outside tires, and I had to buy new tires on Monday after that one. Or there was the great Darlington infield exit that we pulled when I saw nobody else is around. I would just go out and take me a lap around Darlington. So I got out, and this was in my 72 Plymouth Fury. I started down the back straightaway, hitting turn three. Here was a man and his wife and a little girl carrying one of these styrofoam rice chests walking up against the guardrail. So they see me coming and they drop the styrofoam rice chest, which I hit, and it looked like snow going everywhere. But I went ahead and made that lap, and I was coming off of whatever that turn was. That was turn two at the time. Well, when I came off of turn two, Darlington County finest was sitting in the pits waiting for me. I kept going. So he comes out behind me with his little blue lights going, his little siren going. So we're coming around, and I know where that little narrow, skinny gate was that went through between the Robert E. Lee grandstands and that other grandstand. So I cut down toward the pit, slammed on the brakes, and whipped it, and I didn't think this guy was going to make it. But I went through that gate, and doggone it, he came right through behind me. And of course, I climbed the highway, and you couldn't go anywhere because all the traffic was stopped. So he gets out of his car, comes running up there, and I get out of my car and go walking back there, and he said, "If I didn't have an accident to go to, I'd haul your ass to jail right now." So I bowed very low, and I said, "Well, do Lord, please go on to your accident." So I got out of that one.
Good night.
Those are some all the pieces I've been to at all the different
Tim, you didn't tell one of your best ones. You forgot to tell the story of when you went to Talladega for the inaugural race down the new unfinished I-20.
Oh, you want to hear about Yeah, I was going to the race in Talladega, and they told me when you get to Thompson, Georgia, they've got the interstate blocked off, but that's all right. It's paved. You can just go around those barriers and just keep on going. So this was
this
early.
That's a bad ending, I know.
This was early in the morning, so we go around the barriers, and here's this beautiful concrete interstate highway, no highway patrol, no anything anywhere. So we start, you know, 80 miles an hour, 90 miles an hour, 95, 100, 105, 110. And then all of a sudden, right in front of us, there is this great big dirt embankment. There was no way to go off the sides or anything else. You had to, you know. But it was made like a ramp was made. So just like the good old boys in the Dukes of Hazzard, we went over that, which jumped over a great big culvert and came down on the other side. And it slammed the front wheels of my Plymouth down so hard, it bent the fenders to shake the wheels. And then I got out and looked at the car, and both wheels, both tires, were leaning in at the top and out on the bottom. So we made a quick decision what we were going to do. We drove the rest of the way to Talladega on about the inch and a half inside tread on both front tires. But That was a good one. Or there was the time I went to Darlington, and we drove in the back gate coming in under turn three through the tunnel, and we were going to park down in turn four, so we made the turn to go through this high grass. Well, what those fools at Darlington had done was cut the grass from one of those tractors with the big blade on it, which didn't bother to indicate there was a great big deep ditch there. So I'm running about 35 or 40 miles an hour, and I hit this ditch, and the front end of the car went down, and the back end went up a good 4 feet off the ground. And here we're sticking up like we crashed an airplane into the ditch at the Darlington infield. So, oh, man, the fun we had those days.
That makes my getting stopped by about eight cops at Charlotte look kind of pale.
What did you do at Charlotte to get stopped by eight cops?
I went on the track at about 3 o'clock in the morning, the wrong way.
Driving a motorhome.
And they took a dim view of that?
They took a real dim. Well, I was perfectly legal. The only problem was, it was about 3 o'clock in the morning. The first weekend that, and I don't remember the race, but it was the first time that Musco had lit the track, and there was two or three little cars out there. They ran all night long, making sure that they didn't have any light. The aiming the lights basically was what they were doing, and Jay had made arrangements for me to be able to get in. When I got there, I was working Friday evening, so it was about 3 o'clock in the morning by the time I got to the track, and the guy very unceremoniously told me that the gates were locked and I wasn't getting in. And I told him, I said, well, the man told me I could get in. And he says, who? And I said, Jay Howard. And he said, what's your name? And I said, Hugh Overcash. And he said, you can get in. So he swung the gate, and I drove in. What I didn't think to tell him was that I was going to our holding area on the infield, and customarily when we went at off times, we would just go through the outside gate. That was before they finished the new tunnel. We'd go through the outside gate and then just go around the track, usually the wrong way. It was closer that way. So that's what I did. I went through the outside gate. As soon as I cleared the gate, I turned left and started around the track the wrong way to go to where I was supposed to go. Well, I hadn't gotten but just what seemed to be a few hundred feet. I guess it was further than that. And then all of a sudden, every damn cop in the infield at Charlotte surrounded me. What are you doing? Why are you on the track? What are you doing here at 3 o'clock? And I said, I'm just going to work. What's wrong with you people? Oh.
Oh.
And they just said, well, watch out for the cars that are going the other way. Don't hit one of them.
Well, I got one more.
Then you looked in the window. Cars going the other way? What?
Speak, Tim.
Oh, I said I got one more Interstate 20 story if you want to hear it. This guy has concerns going to the races in Atlanta, and this was probably 1970, I think, because we still had the Roadrunners. But as my Roadrunner, Richard's Roadrunner, Tommy Cross, was driving his 55 Chevrolet. My cousin Eddie was driving his 61 Chevrolet. So we're heading down I-20 to Atlanta. It's about 4 o'clock in the morning, and we get over in Georgia, Cody, where the Georgia Highway Patrol racing team has absolutely no sense of humor.
No, they but don't.
We got them on this particular time because there wasn't any traffic out there. So we all hook up in a four-car draft. And when I'm talking about drafting, I'm talking about bump drafting. And we're running probably 110, 115 miles an hour. And we came up over this little hill, and it was the Georgia Highway Patrol sitting on the whatever, safety apron, over there with his radar out. Well, the minute the first car, which was me, came over that hill, and it was like a train. I mean, we were hooked together like a train. His blue light went on, and he started to move, and then he saw, wah, 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 wah. And the blue light went off, and we never saw him again. I guess he figured he was hallucinating.
Do you know how fast you were going, Tim?
I'm sure. I'm sure there's another 1,000 stories out there. For my brother Richard was on here tonight talking about it. You know, he's got a memory like a steel trap, and he could come up and tell you some stories that I'm telling you that we just
were you, were you
but
sure
we did it? We did it as a family, and when we got the motor home in 73, I think 1973, and started traveling by motor home, you know, it was Ricky and my parents, my mother and father, we'd pile up the motorhome and we'd take off to Daytona, Talladega, Darlington, Charlotte, Atlanta, Rockingham, wherever they were racing, wherever we were going. And the stories in the motorhome and the memories of the stories in motorhomes are just, you know, they're incredible. And all the people that we met because of being allowed in the infield as it was in those days, where you could circle up like the covered wagons and you could build your own little compound area inside. And the family from Tennessee, that lady was an excellent baker. So she would bring pies and cookies and cakes. And my mother could cook anything, and she would cook right there at the track in the motorhome. Then we had friends from North Carolina that were always grilling out. In fact, that was the Smithy family, Larry and Kenny and all. But they were grilling out steaks and hamburgers and hot dogs. And we had several of them could play musical instruments. And we never got bored because we would sit around and talk racing in the afternoon. Then when it's got to be close to sundown, the instruments would come out. We'd start singing and playing music. And then as it got later at night, we would tell racing stories. And the very fact that so many of those people have been going to races for so long and had been such a part of it in their lives, if we could have just recorded all of those stories for playback now, it would be one incredibly awesome way to just have racing history right there in front of you.
Well, we just lost video. I got the blue screen of death on the video
feed. Oh, no.
Yeah, I sure did.
Jack, you did
it. No, Danica did it.
It was.
Yeah. It was. It's, yep. Is it Danica Blue?
Yeah. It was. I don't know what. It's been freezing up on me every now and then, and it just crashed. So we're done with the video.
Well, she crashes every week anyway.
No, that was good. That was
That's
cool.
Fun.
Yeah, good stuff.
There's always more stories related to the going to and from the races.
Oh, yeah.
And every time somebody tells one, you think of two or three yourself that you remember that stand out. Some of it happened to you, and some of it happened to some other poor schmuck that was on the side of the road.
Yeah, I can tell you a brief side of the road one.
Tell.
And when I was about 12, I talked my father into going to the Southern 500. We'd never been to the Southern 500. So he had one of his friends, and I had two buddies, and we piled in the station wagon and went to Darlington, went to the race, saw a great race. Fireball won the race. Eddie Pagan went through the wall. Jack Smith went over the wall. But after the race, you know, getting out of the parking lot, the Highway Patrol made us go
Some other way.
Some way that nobody was familiar with, including the two adults in the front seat. So we're going down this country road and back road. And finally, we come to this town. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, we're in this very small town with sidewalks and little houses right close to the road. And Dad pulls that station wagon over, asked some guy that was out raking leaves in his front yard where we were. And I'll never forget it. It's clear as day. The guy says, "Welcome to Bishopville, South Carolina, garden spot of the South."
You must be lost.
Well, one more quick side of the road story then, but this is a different one. And we were going to Darlington when you had to go. There wasn't an Interstate 20 then. You had to go down Highway 34 out of Camden. Well, we were going along, and we stopped at this little roadside gas station that was closed, because it was on Sunday morning and the race was still on Monday. And they had these Coke machines outside that I think you put a dime in, or maybe it was 15 cents, and you pull down this little handle and a little Coke bottle came out. So we put a dime in, pulled down that little handle, and the Coke bottle came out, and then Eddie was standing there waiting to put his dime in, and another Coke bottle came out, and then another Coke bottle came out, and another Coke bottle. We emptied that machine with one dime. So we decided the best thing to do was take all these Cokes with us, and we would stop back by there on the way home Monday and give them to the guy that ran the station. So we kept the count of how many of them we drank, and then we came back on Monday and we stopped, and we told this guy we had about 60 bottles of Coke in the car. And we told him, "All this came out of your machine, and we're here to give them back." And he said, "No, I don't want them. You just keep them. How do I know they came out of my machine?" So anyway, yeah, a crazy, crazy way.
That's cool. That's going to do it, folks. Good stuff. I enjoyed that. That was good. Thanks. Roadside racing history. Thank you for sharing, all of you. Thanks to all of you for tuned in to listen to us tonight. We appreciate that. And we, as always, want to say a special thanks to the men and women that serve our military. Thank you for doing what you do, so that we can all sit here and do this. To each and every one of you, good night. God bless.